change that.
Is that right?
Oh, look who finally decided.
I'm convening this meeting of Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is Monday, March 2nd. We're here to have a public hearing on House Bill 5026, Department of Human Services. Ms. Byerly, would you please introduce this for us?
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair, Member of the Subcommittee. This is another day in our work with learning about the Department of Human Services. Today, the topics for discussion are the Program Design Services Program Unit and Key Performance Measures.
Mr. Sherson, are you going to start?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Scherzinger, from the Chief Operating Officer of the Department of Human Services. And we're here today to do two things. Talk about our program support services and our KPMs. And in the interest, we have in the back the owners of our KPMs, as well as the directors of each of the offices we're going to talk about. In the interest of good logistics, I'm going to go through it. If you have any questions that could be beyond my capacity, which won't take very much, then we can call them up and have them help with the questions. Just quickly, before I dive into this, it may seem odd that we're talking about a support service and KPMs. There really is a strong relationship here in this presentation between the two functions, because it really goes to the question of how an agency achieves their outcomes. As we move from a statewide measure to agency measures to process measures, the program support services that we're talking about we specifically created to help in that process, and that's what's unique about them. And so it's really fairly appropriate that we're talking about them in the same meeting. If you recall, we had you've had earlier a presentation in our from our agency overview, where we talked about where we've been and where we are going. And if you looked back at that, you'd see some things like one department, one mission, leveraging program specialties, being outcome and results-oriented, being customer-focused, and integrated services. And that's really the purpose of these offices that we've created, is to help in that process. And let me sort of illustrate first just by going to the next slide. The notion of our program support services and why we created them, because they're a relatively new creation, is to provide professional support to help each of our programs design and implement better programs. And there's a little chart there that shows that our programs, our five major programs, are ultimately responsible to achieve the outcomes of the agency. They're the ones that deal directly with our clients, our customers, our customer focus, and they have that responsibility. And with that responsibility comes the ability to determine what kind of support services they need. Both these kinds of services we're talking about today and business services, which are different from this, which we'll talk about in a minute. The five program support services we have are business intelligence, program integrity, continuous improvement, IT business support, and licensing. Each one of these serves all programs, and they really are trying to leverage professional support across all these programs to help us ultimately create more integrated services and a greater customer focus. So this is really the notion of how we're going to achieve our outcomes. Our programs deal with the clients, with customer focus, and then they have professional support behind them to help them do that. So that's the logic of what we've set up. So if you go to the next slide, we actually created Program Support Services in 2011. After we went through the creation of the management system and we looked, what you do when you see the management system is you see at a very high level all of the processes that we have to try to achieve our objectives. And when we looked at that, we said, we really have our these kinds of skill sets, these kinds of staff, we have scattered throughout the agency in no particular order. Some programs had strong abilities in some areas, and other ones had none at all. We had reporting scattered across the agency, often in individual people, and the reports they gave were often inconsistent because they were looking at different data sets. And in any event, all of the services we had were focused on particular programs, and they weren't looking across the whole organization. So we went through a process and said, in these areas, we need to create a more central professional ability in these five areas. And we took, in most cases, we took existing staff and reorganized them into these services. So ultimately, their job is to help program achieve outcomes. They directly help programs design and implement strategies and report the results of those strategies. That's different from business services. Business services are like financial services or the budget or HR, which are the more traditional kinds of central services that an agency would have. These are services that directly support the programs and help them do their program work. As I said, they were created in 2011. The purpose is to leverage professionals across programs to create accountability for results, consistency and compliance of reporting, integrating multi-program effects on customers, and help us move from being reactive to proactive. And so you see, when you go back to that, where you've been, where are we going, you see these same things in where we are going. So that's their mission. So the five, I'll just go through each one of them briefly and talk about what each one of them does. The first is the Office of Business Intelligence, and they really have three functions. One is to organize and improve access to data, to get data into data warehouses, and to enable programs to query the data themselves rather than having to go through an individual every time they wanted to get data about their program. They could go in, if it were user-friendly enough, and get the data themselves. To improve the timeliness and accuracy of reports, ensure that it's consistent across reports, to automate reports so that we can reduce the time that it costs to produce them, and then we gave them the mission of maintaining the agency performance scorecard. And then finally, to do analysis and research across program areas to try to get the cross-program effects of what we are doing. On the next page, a few of the achievements of the office, a couple of graphs, one showing the percent of identified data marks that they've put into operational status over the last year, back to September 13, and then their progress toward report automation. This is a statistic that they report regularly to the executive team as a measure of their success. Some of the accomplishments over the last year, one was implementing a child welfare performance database, which actually made searchable data available to staff, to stakeholders, and the public. And then one of their POPs, actually, it's in for the next time, is creation of the Oregon Enterprise Research Dataset and Analytics, which many state agencies are participating in, trying to, again, get data we can leverage across now all departments to help create more integrated services and integrated data.
Yes.
Okay. Jim, I appreciate you sharing what's going on here, this slide right here, with the creation of the database and everything like that. and I understand the need for data. What is your outcome measurements that you're using your data for to get to for us providing more dollars for you? So actually what I'm asking is, how are you going to use that right there to reach some of your outcome measurements, and what are they?
So, Representative Olson, Madam Chair, it sounds like a long answer. I'm trying to think of a short way to answer that question. I think then if you look at the measures we have, the outcome measures we have, and particularly the KPMs, which are statewide measures, they're enterprise-wide measures, they're measures of what we want to achieve as a state. And they're broader than even the measures that we use to measure our own performance as an agency. And in order for agencies to work together, to cut across all the silos of the organizational structure, there needs to be agreement about what the outcome is that we're trying to achieve and how we measure it. And then, in order to develop plans to attack that and to improve that measure, you need to develop measures below that that you can agree to, that you can measure your progress with. Otherwise, you don't have the organizational structure to help you structure your project. You have to use data to create that structure. And that ultimately means agreement on what the measure is and what our agency's role is in improving the measure versus the Department of Education versus the Employment Department, whatever other departments involved in achieving these measures. You've got to have that kind of basic data that says we know what it is that we're trying to achieve and how we're trying to achieve it. And so I think ultimately that's the vision of having KPMs in the first place. It's then how do we, if we're going to really make that operational, we have to deal with what does that mean at the agency level and what does it mean at the frontline level? And I guess that's the only way I can answer that question. Now, if you want, what are the specific measures? I think that's a really long conversation. We have all these KPMs. And I think historically, I mean, I was here back when they created KPMs, working in a very different role. And I think it's always been a problem or an issue as to how do you actually implement them? What does it really mean for a frontline staff person who's out there working with a customer? What does it really mean for what they do that we can tie it all the way back to achieving this KPM? And that's the kind of groundwork that agencies have to do now that they're being held accountable to outcomes. So I don't know if that answered your question.
It didn't.
Okay,
it
so didn't. So maybe you could help me with
the, you know, we can have maybe an offline discussion.
Yeah.
Instead of slowing this down. What is KPM?
Key Performance Measure.
Oh, Key Performance, okay.
Right. I'm sorry.
Mr. Scherzinger, interject an example here of cross-agency or cross-department outcomes that everyone really is responsible for. When I think about the concern about a low graduation rate and how graduation rates are connected to performance in school, academic achievement, and achievement is related to attendance. And when I think about problems with attendance, or academic achievement, we know that kids who are sick or worried or hungry can't learn very well in school, then there's a very clear connection between well-being, hunger, home situations, inability to see well, thus vision screening, hearing screening, not being able to hear, all of that stuff that happens that's related to academic achievement, yet we're scoring an outcome of what's happened in grades 9, 10, 11, 12, and much of that is based on stuff that's happening here in the child welfare area. So How are you going to show us examples of SharePoint?
Of SharePoint?
Of what's in the database, how it's used?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did not have that in this presentation. I think you have seen our, we've given them the scorecard at some point. We could do that, which is our agency scorecard. But we obviously could give you whatever it is you want below that.
I think it would be interesting at some point for all of us, either in a presentation here or for you to just make something available to us, to see a real-life example of what this means. What are agency people looking at that's helpful to them, that's illuminating, that's it helps describe the situation and what could be done to make it better.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I agree. I mean, I think that was a really good example. We have a piece of the academic achievement of kids because we have a child welfare program, and a huge barrier to academic success is issues in the home, and that's our mission. But we have to have we have to work with other agencies in order to actually change the circumstance for that family. And we need to be able to measure whether or not, one of the important measures in that is how well is that kid doing in school. And we don't have access to that, generally speaking. That's one of the, I mean, I have Angela Long here, but I'm assuming that's one of the potential pieces of data they would have in this enterprise database. Now, they're pulling this together largely for research purposes, but ultimately, if you want integrated services, you need to actually have that kind of information operationally so that you can actually measure your success on a child-by-child basis. But we're a long ways from that, just in terms of our technical ability to do that, while at the same time protecting all the data appropriately. Okay, so the Office of Business Intelligence. The next is the Office of Program Integrity. This office is, here we go. This office's responsibility is to objectively check for the accuracy of our eligibility decisions, and that's both the federally required reviews, and to do those reviews, to do those tests and report the results of our compliance with the federal regulations, and to do quality assurance reviews to help internally and do a little bit deeper dive to help our staff both learn what isn't being done appropriately and to build some training around how to do it better. When we created the office, the other goal was to extend these kinds of reviews to all programs, even those programs that we weren't absolutely required to do them. We were doing them in some, but not in others. And obviously, one of the goals of checking for accuracy is to ensure that public funds are being used appropriately, and that's an important goal as well. And then to both publish the errors so staff knows what they are, and to train on proper procedures, and then to facilitate collaboration across programs around how to do program integrity, how to build your program integrity better across all programs. So that's the role of this office. You can see on the next page, this is actually a summary of the results of the accuracy reviews that we do. If we actually had a list of each individual type, I don't think it would fit on the page. It's just showing you this is what we measure, and this is the kind of the results of them. And then I think the big thing is we really, I'm getting training sessions and getting our staff trained.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a follow-up question from your previous slide on the Office of Program Integrity. Does that also include the quality control unit?
Quality control unit. Representative Olson, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Do we have?
Yeah. No, so it does.
I haven't heard the term before.
Okay, QC. So I'm just curious, follow up. How many people do you have assigned to that?
Let's see here. We have, where did I write that down? 59 staff in that unit.
Mm-hmm.
59.
Okay, thank you. Really? You have 59 people assigned to that program?
59 staff, wow. Right. And then you see the number of reviews that they do in a year, about 40,000, 45,000 QA, and about those are individual tests, and about almost 6,000 QC reviews.
So just QA.
Okay, thank you. Stop there.
That's not everything they do. Yeah. Because it's the training, they have to do the training and everything else. And then a few of the things that the accomplishments over the last year, they moved to a new automated system on SNAP. Really worked on developing some feedback loops in child welfare. They've increased the communication with child welfare program management. And then the TANF work and the child care work is an expansion of the QA-QC work that we weren't doing before. So the third office is the Office of Continuous Improvement. This office is a little different from the other five in that we, generally speaking, didn't have a lot of staff that did this work. This office is a relatively small office. It's 26 people, I think. And what they do is they have experts in lean, so process improvement experts. And we didn't have a lot of that kind of capacity, but we decided that we really needed to have it. When we started the original transformation efforts, when DHS was combined as one agency, and then ultimately when we split out into two, that we had to build a lean capacity that we didn't have before. So we created this office, and largely what they do is projects to streamline performance, especially focused around the field structure and the field offices. They do some central work, but if you look at the statistics there, it's largely out in the field structure. And they've worked with that field structure to develop which projects they do. And we have a list of all the ones they've done and the ones they're currently working on. If you're interested in that, we essentially created the office by not hiring as much in the field staff or in the program design staff, with the notion that the process improvement itself would reduce would make the process more efficient and reduce the need for frontline staff. And that's sort of the theory, that's the operational assumption that we worked on. Their mission is, as I said, to conduct the projects to streamline performance and then to facilitate incorporation of continuous improvement in all of our offices. So in the long run, the ultimate goal is that every manager in DHS has lean skills and knows how to support the lean daily management system, which is the system we use at the front lines. And that ultimately you don't need as much of a central office to have that capacity, because you build that capacity within your organization. It should be a core capacity of management in DHS, but we're not at that level yet, and so we need this office to target improvement projects.
I'd love to hear an example, a real world example of something that one of these 26 people was able to achieve. I'll give an example to the committee. Several years ago, one of the offices, DHS offices in around the state, was taking, I believe it was up to, it was over a week, might have even been 2 or 3 weeks, to certify someone for eligibility. Someone was literally hungry, needing food assistance, and couldn't even be certified for days and days and days. It was measured in weeks. And through a process improvement review, that was reduced to under 3 days. So someone who really needed help right away could get help pretty quickly. Not immediately, but much more quickly. So I think that fits in the category of this kind of thing. What, can you give us an example of something that's happened in the past year?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I could have Wes come up and talk in more detail about this, but I think you have sort of three examples on the bottom of page of that next slide of things they've been doing lately. So a big part of the effort that you talked about before was creating some standardized business processes to schedule better people's interviews for SNAP. So they've done a fair amount of work in standardizing business processes in child welfare field offices to get process efficiency. So that's one that's there. And they've also worked a lot on administration of the jobs program to meet the federal participation rate requirements, and that was a huge, meeting the participation rate requirements was a huge imperative, I guess we would say, for the agency, because of the penalties involved if you don't meet those requirements. And as well on the streamlining the APDDD federal review reporting processes. Now, I think if you would like some more details about any one of those, I could have Wes come up and talk about exactly what they've done in those areas, what the specific improvements were. I don't know if that...
I would like to hear one or two examples of what we did to help people. It's a lot of this is a lot of information about something that, in theory, sounds like a really great idea, but sometimes
just pick one of them.
Sometimes it's too theoretical, and we find out lots of people have been spinning their wheels, coming up with good ideas, but did something actually get done where people's lives improved?
So Madam Chair, I'm Wes Rios. I'm the director of the Office of Continuous Improvement for DHS, and I can use an example that Mr. Scherzinger just gave, but we also have several others. And if you'd like, I can provide a list after this. And so this morning, we'll look at the Streamline the Jobs program to meet federal participation requirements. That was a culmination not only of our office, but many of the district manager and field service groups to target a percentage to say, in the next 3 months, and this would have been this last summer, to say in 3 months, what can we help support to get to a much closer number. At that time, we targeted 20% participation for a specific portion of the JAWS program. And so it was a concerted effort that really looked at not only protocol development, so the protocols would help spell out what the workers would be doing at the field service offices with their clients or customers, but also on the other side, it was a concerted effort to focus on the partners and so asking them questions about when they're delivering services back to us, how can we improve that timing as well as improve the accuracy of what our employees were inputting into tracks. So it initially helped resolve this last federal fiscal year, but now this current year, where we've actually targeted all the field service offices, in particular the offices that have the larger population. So if you look at the Portland metro area, the Eugene metro area, the Salem area down south in Jackson, Josephine counties, they have much larger populous areas that include more clients that we're serving. We're actually helping them streamline those processes at the field structure level, but also with their partners. So I believe before the end of this year, we'll actually meet those marks. We're trajectory-wise, we're actually on track to be getting much closer to that 20% than we were the previous 2 years.
I'm just trying to track, and I'm sorry I'm late. But is this similar to, you said protocol, but is this somehow similar to a desk audit?
I would say there's some similarities, but part of part of what we've done is really taken the process oftentimes has changed at the local level. So when you have a number of employees, they will change the way the business is being delivered. We're helping try to get back to not only through training, but looking at the necessary steps to get the work done and helping them get through that.
Well, follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So in this process, what actual trends or problems did you identify that required some comprehensive changes?
I'd say some of the initial things were delays, just maybe something sitting too long because of, once again, having numerous clients to work with, as well as not quite understanding when to... Okay, delays for sure, and then also workarounds that maybe were not the most efficient workarounds. So we've helped them cut out some of the workarounds and get from direct A to B.
I don't follow. What's workaround?
For instance,
I come from the old school, so you have to educate me.
For instance, a case manager may have had some sort of delay because of whether it be the way they were trained. They might have input the information up front into the track system, and then the follow-up appointment might have been I apologize, I don't have all the specifics with me today, but I could get more detail for you if that's what you wanted. I just know for sure our issues have been really around delays in service from on the case manager side, and we're really helping them improve that through protocol development, much like a desk guide. That is part of it, but then two, just reaffirming that they know the correct process to follow when getting these people into the services they need.
So it sounds like a massive training undertaking that's needed or required of your case managers.
I'm not certain that's the case, but I'm not certain. I'm sorry.
I think we're going to hold you up from finishing the presentation. Let's move on to the next
slide. I apologize.
Thank you for coming up and letting us know a little bit more.
The next office is the Office of IT Business Support. The role of the office is really threefold. It's number one, it's to help the people in IT, the developers that develop new applications, understand business needs. So it's to work collaboratively with that staff, with the development staff, on projects, all the way from planning them all the way through the execution of the process, and to support the business governance process for setting IT priorities. So they really are translators. They understand the business, but they also understand how IT developers talk, and they can translate between the business need to the developers to help them actually achieve a better project.
I'll let you finish this slide.
The second is to help the business maximize the benefit of technology. So in other words, working with the people on the business side, the field staff, the central staff, to improve business processes so they can use the technology better, to conduct training, to manage system access. And for we have many of our users who are not DHS employees, but are our partners, and to run a help desk for those users of our program applications to help them use that technology better. And then the third is to integrate IT implications into program policy discussion. So what they really are is translators, people who understand the IT well enough that they can translate between the business users, between the policymakers, and between the IT developers to make it clear, to really optimize the use of technology. And that's
Senator
their role.
Senator Steiner-Hayward, did you have a
Thank you.
Question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. Mr. Scherzinger, recently Sarah Miller came over to you all as Chief Information Officer from DAS, and could you talk a little bit about, help me understand the connection between this Office of IT Business Support and what her role is in the agency, and then how all of that ties into the new stage gate processes that Mr. Pettit has put in place as Chief Information Officer for the state, because obviously making sure that we're doing exactly the right IT in the right way at the right time is critically important to the state and has been something of a concern in the past.
So Senator Steiner-Hayward, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sarah is the COO for our new COO for technology. She's sort of serving that sort of halftime for now because she's got the Magi project to get done. But this office reports to her, and so it's aligned that way. I'm helping in a lot of the operational side of it, but in terms of the big picture and the direction of the office, she's really in charge of it. This office really started down the stage gate process before the stage gate was had any really meat to it. The whole notion of how to do a business case and how to do a good business case, which is the core of the stage gate process. They started with what was one of the efforts that we started with this group. We really haven't had strong business engagement with IT. In fact, many of the functions that ought to be on the business side had been on the IT side before in the basically the old DHS. And projects tended to be very IT driven, and the attachment to the business need was always a bit problematic. So we created this office really to fill that gap. And we actually brought some people over from the IT side to help create it, as well as took some people that we already had in the agency. That's really its mission. Its mission is to be sure that the business side of the stage gate process is performed appropriately, and that we have a very robust governance on the business side to set priorities, because we have way more projects than we can do, and we have to do a better job of saying this is what the business need, this is the more important business need. And we also have to do a much better job of coming to you and telling you what, because a lot of our IT support, our IT applications need a lot of work. And we need to do a better job of being able to communicate what those trade-offs are given the capacity we have to improve the applications that we have. And so that's why we created that office, and that's why we hired Sarah, and I think it fits together. that way. Now, we have a lot of growth that has to happen here. It's been a very challenging 2 years. We had to react a lot to the external impacts on our capacity. The one thing we were able to get done was with OHA develop the IT strategic plan that's copied here, that at least the one main chart out of it, to talk about what are our business needs, and what's the IT impact of those business needs. And you see reflected that from that, where we've been, where we're going, you see what that means on the IT side in that chart. That if you want to be more customer focused, if you want more integrated services, you need to have a comprehensive view of the client. You need to really have a trusted source of data that you can all agree on if you're working cooperatively across agencies. We need to have a lot more business automation. So those are the that's what this office is doing.
Very quick follow-up, yes. Madam Manager. Thank you. Mr. Scherzinger, and I would agree. I mean, when I look at this, it's funny. I just came from testifying in Judiciary on a bill that came out of the Senate Bill 450 Task Force, the Streamlining Delivery of Human Services. And the bill that I was just testifying on was one to allow DOJ to work with all these different agencies to develop uniform understanding of what information can be shared when and release of information forms. And I'm very pleased to see about this comprehensive view of clients, because I do think that people fall through the gaps and we don't know, you know, name changes or people move or who knows what. My only request, dreaming big, is that you start to think, as they are in the very early stages in the pay for prevention program, looking at how do you wrap in education, for example, because we know that food insecurity and homelessness contribute to poor educational attainment. And so understanding how kids are connecting with schools and families are connecting is going to be very important in the long term as well. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Scherzinger, this committee received a lot of testimony in the past couple of weeks about something that isn't working very well. And it's related to something that's expressed on this slide, reacting to external impacts. There was a federal regulation that we had to comply with. We are requiring caregivers to keep track of their time in a much more specific way, down to the quarter hour and exactly what kind of service was being provided. So the plan of care system was apparently tacked on to an existing system, ironically called Express. And it's cost people an enormous amount of time, and there was a huge dissatisfaction across the state. What we have done has impacted thousands of people. Was this office involved in helping review the business processes as well as the IT solution, or was this office not really functioning that way at the time that started to develop?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, this office, the core of the office, has been involved with the Express system for a long time. It's been historically, even back when I first came to the department, it's been a system that they were moving toward to replace a far more outdated system that was very problematic for the department. The new requirement on plan of care or the Department of Labor regulations added a much more difficult element to which has actually been a difficult or the IT support in this area where we have home care workers or other kinds of workers that are represented but not directly employees is just a difficult population to serve with the IT systems that we have. And so this office, to answer your question, this office was involved in that. The only real practical approach they had was to try to extend existing technology to serve that, and at least until they started looking at the alternatives. And it is still one of the high priority projects they have. The one thing we are doing is trying to get, and that's a big demand on this office now, is to implement a new intake and prioritization process for all projects that we have that would deal with a lot of the issues that you're talking about up front. It would require that we deal with them up front rather than to simply be reacting with the systems we have. And that is a heavy lift. That's not something we've done very well. And
I'm going to ask you to reflect again on something that you've already answered a question from Senator Steiner Hayward, but I'm going to ask it again at this point in a different way. It's about the relationship of DHS information technology activities with other agencies or with the state CIO. Does DHS IT attempt to resolve all of its all of the demands it has and all of its issues completely in-house, or does DHS IT ever kick around ideas with the state CIO's office that also has to deal with really big scale problems?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think, well, the answer is yes. We do have a lot more frequent conversations with the state CIO. Certainly Sarah does, I do. And Sarah's doing it more now because now that's her role. And I do think that the kinds of things we do are historically a little different than what DAS has done. And I think with the new state CIO in a different kind of role than the state CIO has had before, it's a lot easier to have those conversations. So we have them all the time. We're very supportive of the notions of the enterprise architecture, which really gets to the bit, which really is one way of getting to the business need, which I think is really important to do. So, and I think the new Stagegate process creates a much healthier way of having that conversation, because you're basing it on a real business case, not just something that meets the technical requirements of passing a particular set of tests, but in fact, you have to really create a business case that meets that meets a higher standard, and that facilitates a much better conversation about what are you really trying to do, and is it really going to meet the business need that you have.
Thank you for your response. Yeah. That's plenty.
Yeah. So the last of the five offices, the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, and it may not appear as obvious as to why that's tied into this set of direct support for programs. But I think the more we've gotten into the issues in licensing and regulatory oversight, I think it's how it relates to being outcome-driven is becoming clearer and clearer. I think we've had a lot of conversation about how to minimize the burden of licensing reviews and surveys, as well as the entity reviews that entities do, because they have clients that are placed within a licensed provider, and how we need to streamline that process, how we need to share more data across different kinds of review efforts, and how we need to do more joint reviews. And there's been really a lot of conversation about that. But I think the thing that's becoming clearer and clearer is that if you really want to have integrated services or even contracts that are based on performance, on outcomes, that you have to minimize these burdens. You have to be able to, if you want our providers to be able to integrate services, to perform more different kinds of services, you can't have a lot of licensing barriers. You can't, every time they want to do a new service, go through a whole new process. If you really want to facilitate that to happen, you have to move toward a more performance-based, outcome-based system. And I think that's how this kind of operation ultimately will contribute to getting more integrated service delivery and more performance-based contracting. But the current office has licenses and overseas providers in the five areas that are listed there. They do licensing services, including the on-site inspections and the surveys. They handle complaints and corrective actions and do rules and technical assistance.
Senator Winters.
Just a quick question, and you talked about streamlining licensing and removing barriers. At what point do you think that you will come back to us with a report that will let us know what barriers have been removed and what can we see in the future? I mean, this I think of any undertaking that you're doing, it has a very positive, you know, to me, because we hear from the providers and we hear how cumbersome and, you know, laborious things are. So can you, you know, kind of help us to understand when we can actually see some results in the work that you're doing?
And I'm going to pile on to that. A few years ago, the legislature passed a bill that you've heard this. I know it very well because it was my bill, asking for the department to establish a team to eliminate redundant audits and reports, where we know that there are many examples of 80-90% overlap, even in the questions that are being asked multiple times. And a year later, the team hadn't even been formed to start looking into it. So I also would like to hear what this is in the area, not of licensing, but then once someone's been licensed, the regulatory oversight end of things. So I also would like information on which of those have been addressed now.
Senator Winters, Madam Chair, members of the committee, so I did a draft of a report that I need to get out to the different players. And so you should have that reasonably soon. Not sure what kind of reaction I'm going to get, but...
follow-up, Madam Chair. In all sincerity, this is probably, of what I've heard so far, when we talk about efficiency and being effective, one of the areas that is, I think, critical, because you know we lay so much redundancy on top of providers, and we inundate them with all of our paperwork and duplication and what have you. So I'm very curious to see what your draft report says.
All right. In terms of the office itself, they've done a lot of work this year around just getting a more efficient survey process. They're actually very challenged by the number of reviews that they need to do as the provider group grows, and the number of complaints have risen, and the requirements for corrective action. So they've done a lot to try to make the survey process more efficient, to in order to meet the actual requirements, the very, especially on the nursing facilities, very technical requirements and time requirements to do the surveys to get the licensing done. They're still challenged on keeping up and meeting the goal, especially on nursing facilities, of meeting the requirement for how often they have to review each licensee. The other things that they've worked on have been creating a more useful website and a lot of work on collaboration with other safety entities, with the long-term care ombudsman. They've started a quarterly review, going through with them all the citations and the facility safety trends, doing some joint site visits. They formed a adult foster home advisory committee, done some initiatives with the long-term care quality steering committee, and a lot of work around how they work with, and this you'll see some of this in the report that we were just talking about, the interaction between the licensing agency and the agencies that actually place people with providers, and how those two interact with the provider is a big part of that reduced burden. Because the program, or it could be CCOs or whoever it is that actually place people, they have a duty to be sure that the services they're getting are what they paid for and they're of quality. And so they conduct reviews and audits, as well as the licensing agencies. And then, of course, you have agency or providers that are licensed by multiple for multiple reasons, and so you have a sort of a coordination issue across both. And so a lot of work with our DHS offices that that place people with these providers to streamline that review, as well as with other agencies. So in terms of the dollars, you see the budget, the overall budget for these services is, and this is $51 million in federal funds, $28 million in general funds, and about 2.5 other funds, a total of $82 million for all of these. That actually excludes the Office of Continuous Improvement, because when we kind of created them out of whole cloth, we bill those costs out to the different programs that use their services. So they're not really in this number, right?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
And then,
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Scherzinger, I absolutely support the principles that you've outlined and why all these offices were established. $82 million is a lot of money to run all these program support services. And I know you all run a lot of programs, and I know that this is a tiny fraction of your budget overall. But I'm kind of curious if you have any sense of what the ROI is. Obviously, compliance is important, right? Yeah. And making sure that we avoid fines and other unnecessary expenditures is a clear ROI. Obviously, not investing in IT is helpful, but I wonder if you've had any ability to quantify at some level, because I'm perfectly willing to invest this kind of money in these kinds of programs because it's a sound business practice. It's helpful if we also understand that it's a sound business practice, you know, financially, too.
So, Senator Hayward, Madam Chair, members of the committee, included in that is are some POPs. I think that's one thing you'd have to take. You'd have to consider that separately. I think the non-MAGI eligibility projects in this budget, the data analytics that we talked about earlier, is in this budget. So not all of it is staffing, of that $80 million. So that reduces it somewhat. I know we haven't done what I guess you would say a formal ROI on it. I'm not quite sure how you would do that. Because, as you said, many of these things are largely these were people that we took out of program and put in these offices to perform the same function, and we're working to make that function more efficient.
Okay.
So, in that sense, we haven't done a specific ROI on it. We could do, and we have. And we could go through that very specifically within each one of these offices, exactly what they do and why that makes sense. For example, in the licensing office, there are very specific requirements about what a survey entails, how long it has to take, how many people have to be there, what training do they have to have. And when you add all of that up and you take the number of providers that we have, it adds up to those dollar amounts. But we could, and we've done this with our executive team, had the director come in of that office and say, here's the work I'm getting done, and here's what it's taking to get it done, and here's why, with graphs and charts. And I think that, so we haven't done an ROI in the sense that you're talking about it, but I do think we've run these directors in, through their paces about why it takes that kind of money to do the work that they do.
Thank you. I don't follow up if I could, Madam Chair. I don't think Mr. Scherzinger was asking for a formal ROI in the business sense of the word. I guess I'm just trying to get some sense, and I think you've largely provided it, about why these are important for the viability and why they help actually protect taxpayer dollars and federal dollars that we're leveraging.
Right. Right.
And that's really what I was trying to get at. I didn't ask my question in the most artful way. Thank you.
Okay. So on the each office is on that next page. And so the largest there is the IT business supports, about 41% of the total, $33 million. As I said, the non-Magi eligibility pop is about 7.5 of that. There's about 50 total staff in that office. On the licensing and regulatory oversight is the $29 million. There's 116 staff there, largely the surveyors that do the licensing reviews. In the Office of Program Integrity, there's 59 staff, about $10 million. And the Office of Business Intelligence, about 32, 33 staff, $8.9 million. And as I said, the data analytics POP is included in that budget. And then continuous improvement has 26 staff, and we bill those costs out to the, they're not in that central budget, but they bill those costs out to each of the users based on that chart that you saw back on there. So that's the quick financial run through. So I guess we're to the KPMs, unless there's any more questions on. Okay. I guess the protocol is to go through the any of the changes to the QPMs that we're proposing. And the first one is on KPM 2, which is TANF family stability. The old measure was the percentage of children entering foster care who received TANF as cash assistant within the prior 2 months. So it's the this is tricky. It's the number that went into foster care that received TANF assistance, and this changes it to the percentage of children receiving TANF who entered foster care. And it what that really is a more direct measure of the effect of TANF on entering foster care. It's much easier to interpret if the that percentage is dropping, that TANF may be helping with that drop. The way it was before was that if the percentage who if you take all of the children that entered foster care and you ask what percent of them were on TANF, that number could go down just because the TANF program was smaller. Or if the TANF program was growing, that number could go up just because there are more TANF kids out there. And this is, we shifted this measure so it was a more direct measure of the effect of TANF. So it's the kids that are on TANF did that percentage drop that went into foster care. So that's a shift to a more direct measure. On KPM 8, previously we had a measure that was a composite measure. It took four things into account with respect to how quickly kids that went into foster care got reunified back with their parents. And it was, because it was a composite measure, it took four different measures and then sort of mathematically combined them into one. It was hard to understand and hard to figure out how to impact it. So the proposal is to shift it to a direct measure of the percentage of foster children exiting to reunification within 12 months. So it's how many can you get back to reunification within 12 months? It's just much more straightforward measure.
And I would like to confirm, because the word reunification is used, this is with family.
With family. Right.
Not permanency of some other sort. Right. And does it mean it was a parent, or could it be someone in the extended family?
Is that
Do you know?
Where's my measure? Well,
it's only the parent.
It's only the parent.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have a whole bunch of questions, but I'll just ask one. That statement being said, the timeliness for reunification within 12 months, is that a hard and fast stat, or are the children considered individually, and how
so,
1 or 2 weeks before or after that deadline might make a difference?
Okay.
It's not a deadline.
This is Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Lois Day. I'm the director for the Child Welfare Program at the Department of Human Services. With respect to this KPM, it is 12 months. Those returned within 12 months. So it would be those returned within a day all the way up to 364 days.
And to clarify, this is not an imposed deadline. This is just a way of measuring. 12 months was selected. It could have been selected at 8 months or 14 months or some other number.
Chair Nathanson, that's correct. It's an indicator that's also used on a federal level, so we can compare ourselves to other states.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for asking my second question.
Just follow up.
Representative Olson.
This is also part of what we're trying to do with differential response, too. There's a connection here?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Olson, there's four KPMs for child welfare: timely reunification, timely adoption, absence of repeat abuse, and we're proposing a new one you'll hear about in a moment, which is children served at home. Those four are key indicators of all the initiatives we spoke about last week.
That's right. Okay, thanks.
Good. So the next one is KPM DIME, which was another one that Lois was just mentioning, median months to adoption, and it's the percent of legally free children adopted in less than 12 months. And I think the change here is the legally free language, which allows comparison to other states because of the national standard. So I don't know if you had any more to say about that.
I don't.
Okay. And let's see, your other one is, well, we'll get to that one in a minute. Okay. KPMs 13 and 14. This is, oh, wait. Oh, no, I confused myself. 13 is the percentage of individuals with developmental disabilities who live in community settings of five or fewer. That's the existing measure. The new proposed measure is the percentage of individuals enrolled in a developmental disabilities program who receive services in their own home. So the difference is that that things like 24-hour group homes would not be included in this measure anymore. So it's a tougher standard, is that we're trying to get people to be served in their own home. And that this purpose of this measure is to help people live as independently as possible. So like I said, this is a higher standard. It's service in your own home. And then KPM 14, this is the percentage of people with developmental disabilities who receive services who are working in integrated employment settings. That's the was the old measure. The new measure is services in supported employment. And the reason for this change, it aligns with the Oregon Employment First policy and this target was set by a statewide policy group that includes legislators. This is a huge issue. Many of you probably know about it already. And this is aligning this measure with the Employment First efforts. Then 15 and 16, both of these measures deal with abuse of adults. And the first one is, we're actually recommending ultimately, despite the fact that we had in our, a year ago when we put forward recommendations, we were going to recommend a change to this. Now we're recommending that we keep the current one that we have. The measure that we have is the percent of people in KPM 15 with developmental disabilities experiencing abuse, and with 16, it's physical seniors and adults with physical disabilities experiencing abuse. And as I said, the recommendation is to keep that measure. The struggle that we have had is that when you try to measure abuse in licensed settings, there's a fairly strong ability to collect that data. When you get out of licensed settings in more community settings out in the community itself, it's a much more difficult measure. What this really highlights is that there is a difference between a statewide measure, because as a state, what we care about is how much abuse is happening regardless of where it's happening. As an agency, we have to somehow measure our performance on the things that we control, which or have programs that we are working on to control. And sometimes that means the measure is different. And so we look, for example, at what a re-abuse rate is. If we have evidence of abuse and we do something, how often does re-abuse happen? But maybe that is something that we need to look at as an agency for our own performance. But the overall statewide goal still is reduction of abuse, and we have to be able to create that distinction in how we manage our own affairs plus how we articulate a statewide goal. So the one thing we are doing with these two measures is to try to develop a better measure of abuse when you get out in the community.
I'm going to make a quick comment here, and then we have only about 10 minutes to get through all the rest of the slides. My comment is, I don't know if this is the exact language that we will see in the KPM, but I find it to be a little bit loose. It says the percentage experiencing abuse. It's not specific to reports of abuse, it's experiencing abuse. And that could beg the question, well, are we doing surveys to see if people say they're experiencing abuse? So will this just be reports of abuse?
So it currently is reports, but they're actually working on trying to get a better measure, maybe by a survey, of particularly abuse that occurs outside of a licensed setting.
Okay, so the language is a little bit loose intentionally.
Right, I think it's actually, we're not changing the measure.
Mm-hmm.
It's just now, can we actually live up to the measure with actual adequate data? I think is the issue.
So, Madam Chair, that's really interesting. See if I can respond to that somehow. If by inquiry as to whether or not someone has experienced an abuse, what liability does that lie then rest with the agency to have to follow up with investigation when somebody chose not to report it initially?
So, Representative Olson, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Well, that's a good question. I don't know that has that come up in your conversation at all? I know you've had a lot of conversation about it. Or you want to let us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marie Cervantes, and I'm the Director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. To answer your question in two parts, when we have substantiated abuse, and I think that is what the KPM is referencing, we do have a responsibility and obligation to address that. Some of the steps that we might take is to understand the type. So, for instance, if it is financial abuse, and we can determine which program that it's occurring in, we can find out what's causing that. Let's say financial abuse was associated with five different caregivers in a typical facility having access to money, or maybe our policies aren't strong enough. We can work with the program or the licensing office to reduce that level of abuse in that particular program area. In regard to reporting, we do a lot of outreach and awareness to get at underreporting. It is a very serious issue, not only here in Oregon, but also nationally. So we rely on using things like the SAFE number to encourage reporting. We do a lot of awareness and outreach, including a banker's kit to do work with the Oregon Bankers Association, just to name a couple.
So I think the question was, if you did a survey and somebody reported abuse, what would you do?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if there was a survey and there was a report of abuse, that would involve our office, the abuse office, working with the licensing office to investigate that. The surveyors would either report it to us, or if it fell within their purview, they would investigate it themselves. Either way, the offices would be coordinating on what the finding was.
I'm not sure that's a measurement you want to use, be truthful with you, because that's almost like sending out a survey to a random selection of people throughout the state of Oregon. Have you ever been burglarized?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, members of the committee, this measure here was really not only to track abuse in licensed settings, which we have done for many years, but it was also to get at abuse that's occurring in people's own homes. That is something new. As you see, there are a lot of services being built for people and received in their own homes. We wanted to add an additional measure to try and track that. Some of the difficulties that Mr. Scherzinger mentioned were around getting a denominator for people with disabilities that live in Oregon. We can use census data. We can use disability-type data to try to get at that. That's a more difficult measure to have. But in facility data, we can use items such as a bed count for a denominator to help track that abuse. So this is really expanding in response to community abuse and the increases that we're seeing.
Madam Chair, I just think that's unnecessary, just that measurement myself. But.
Ms. Byerly, would you make note that we should discuss this a little more after today?
Thank you.
Now.
Okay. So, so essentially with 15 and 16, the recommendation was to keep the ones we have and continue to work on actually how we define them. On KPM 18,
you're going to have to talk really fast.
Okay, which is service equity. The thing we're struggling with here is that actually every one of our programs has a measure of service equity, and we follow it up regularly in our QBRs, how well we're doing on. The difficulty that we're having is how do we create one composite measure agency-wide on our services in that makes intuitive sense, that people can interpret. In some programs, underrepresentation is a good thing. In other programs, overrepresentation may be a good thing. And how to cut across all our programs and come up with one composite measure on service equity is a challenge. Now, we feel actually pretty good about what's happening at the program level. It's just that we're struggling with how to define it with one number agency-wide. Anyway, so right now our recommendation is to keep working on how to do that. And then the last, let's see, we have two new KPMs, one that Lois just talked about, children served by child welfare residing in the parental home. And then the next one is TANF job placements, the percentage of clients who achieve job placement each month compared to those anticipated to achieve placement. So it's a measure of how well the TANF program is doing to get clients in job placement. So did I get through quickly enough? And then at the end, you see a list of all of our, ultimately, our proposed KPMs, including the existing ones. And I think that's just the, this is just the next steps in our presentation.
Will you advance the slide, please?
There you go. There's a list of all the KPMs.
Okay, there's just a couple of minutes now in case the committee has any questions about this.
I thought you wanted me to finish this fast.
2 minutes. Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Byerly, tell us what happens the rest of the week.
Madam Co-Chair, tomorrow is public testimony. So, as you know, we had public testimony on aging people with disabilities and vocational rehabilitation and intellectual and developmental disabilities programs a couple weeks ago. Tomorrow, the focus will be on child welfare and self-sufficiency programs. And then the day after, we have Ms. Kelly Seale be back for a wrap-up. Again, we will have more work with the agency in phase two, but this kind of concludes sort of the first part of our work with the agency and committee. And then I've lost my mind about what happens on Thursday.
Thank you all for being here.
Board of Nursing is Thursday.
As you've seen, you just never know when your section might be called up to answer a question. So for those of you who got called up on the spur of the moment, thanks for coming up.
Anything else from the committee?
We're adjourned.